And now for some people's history, our history, to look back on, remember, and be inspired by. First, for another day of note in Martin Luther King Jr.'s life, one we don't usually recognize or celebrate. On January 21st, 1956, Martin Luther King Jr. and 100 other participants in the Montgomery bus boycott are indicted for conspiracy to conduct an illegal boycott and are sentenced to prison. The cases are eventually settled by $100 fines. Later that year, the Supreme Court rules that segregation of buses is unconstitutional. More recently, in 2002, on January 25th, Israeli refuseniks issue a declaration refusing to serve in the occupied territories. The Refuser Solidarity Network's website, www.refusersolidarity.net, tells us that there are now 1,664 refusers. And here is their January 2006 update on the situation. Conscientious Objectors in Israel's Military Jails, by Miriam Hadar and Sergei Sandler of New Profile. Conscientious objectors have been part of Israeli society since the 1940s, since Israel's invasion of Lebanon in the 1980s, and more prominently from the inception of the Second Intifada in October 2000. Conscientious objection has become an increasingly prominent phenomena on the public agenda. Unlike in other countries, Israel maintains an extremely narrow definition of conscience, equating conscientious objection only with some forms of pacifism. Even that definition has not been formally set in any document. Conscientious objection is not legally recognized for men, and formal recognition of it for women that existed until recently is no longer implemented. Furthermore, Israel offers objectors no alternative civilian service. The Shministim letter marked a watershed in the refusal movement. This letter, signed by 62 high school seniors in the fall of 2001 and resubmitted with more than 400 signatures a year later, announced these young people's intention to refuse conscription and has resulted in a more or less steady presence of COs, conscientious objectors, in Israeli military jails. The Shministim were soon joined by another collective declaration of refusal, this time selective refusal to serve in the occupied territories, released in January 2002 and signed by more now than 600 reserve soldiers, many of whom also spent time in prison. Until the end of 2004, military law was more lenient toward young women who refused to enlist. As a result, a number of male COs sent to prison has exceeded that of women COs. However, now that men and refusers are treated equally, more women can be expected to go to jail on grounds of conscientious objection. Currently, there are two declared conscientious objectors in Israeli military jails. One is Wissam Kablan, age 20, a member of the Druze community, has been serving more than 100 days in military prison and is now awaiting trial before a military tribunal. Son of Sohil Kablan, himself a CO, Wissam refuses to serve the occupation army and will not take up arms against his fellow Arab people. Yuri Natan, age 19, is currently serving 90 days in military prison. In his letter explaining to the Minister of Defense why he feels he must refuse, he writes, "My opposition against the occupation has human grounds. It is based on empathy, something which every human being should and can experience. Those who do not feel empathy for people who suffer, those who ignore the pain of their fellow humans, are, in my opinion, denying their own humanity. The sense of human identification is a natural human attribute. Each human being should be expected to understand the suffering of the other. Those who close their eyes to the suffering of people who belong to other groups are shutting themselves off and are undermining human nature." Yuri, like Wissam, was not granted a hearing before the Army's Conscience Committee, which is authorized to recommend their exemption. Last month, Wissam and Yuri were joined by a woman refuser, Idan Halili, age 19. Idan refuses to serve in the army on specific feminist grounds, as she describes in her letter to the Minister of Defense. The army is an organization whose most fundamental values cannot be brought into harmony with feminist values. It is a patriarchal organization. Patriarchy consists of a hierarchic social structure which is underwritten by quote-unquote masculine values, such as control, a power orientation, and the repression of emotion. The army is hierarchical, and this, by definition, does not allow for equality. Indeed, the army's demand for uniformity and conformity makes it impossible for individuals to express various different identities and needs. Such a type of organization usually undermines the weaker groups within as well as outside it. As a feminist, I feel committed to enable myself and other women to experience our autonomy and to be part of society without being forced to enter an organization that exposes us to oppression. Idan was very recently invited to explain herself to the Army's Conscience Committee, and a few days ago the committee announced Idan's exemption from military service. They refused, however, to grant her an exemption on grounds of conscience and preferred to motivate it as exemption due to incompatibility. Throughout 2005, an additional 6 young men have spent periods of varying length in Israel's military jails on grounds of declared conscientious objection. They have been accompanied and supported by the new group of Sheministim, an organization of more than 250 young high school graduates who signed a collective declaration of refusal to serve in the army in the beginning of 2005. Refusal in Israel, however, is a wider-reaching phenomenon than meets the eye. Large percentages of young enlistment-aged people are disqualified and never join the ranks of the army. Though we obviously do not have clear data, we know that for a sizable and growing number of these people, reasons of conscience and refusal to serve the occupation are at least partly the underlying motivation. Moreover, there are many who end up refusing to serve due to economic hardship, either explicitly or implicitly. There is growing public awareness of the profound connections between the occupation, the militarization of Israeli society, and the growing poverty of large parts of its society. Again, that article on conscientious objectors in Israel's military jails was from the Refuser Solidarity Network's website, www.refusersolidarity.net. They have lots more info if you want to go and check it out. For our last anniversary, January 22, 1973, Roe v. Wade, women finally win control of their reproductive rights. The following information is from www.saveroe.com, which is focusing on defeating Samuel Alito's appointment to the Supreme Court. January 22nd marks the 33rd anniversary of the U.S. Supreme Court's announcement of its decision in Roe v. Wade, the case that legalized abortion nationwide. The decision challenged a Texas statute that made it a crime to perform an abortion unless a woman's life was at stake. The case had been filed by Jane Roe, an unmarried woman who wanted to safely and legally end her pregnancy. Siding with Roe, the court struck down the Texas law. In its ruling, the court recognized for the first time that the constitutional right to privacy is broad enough to encompass a woman's decision whether or not to terminate her pregnancy. At the time the decision was handed down, nearly all states outlawed abortion except to save a woman's life or for limited reasons such as preserving the woman's health or instances of rape, incest, or fetal anomaly. Roe rendered these laws unconstitutional, making abortion services safer and more accessible to women throughout the country. The decision also set a legal precedent that affected more than 20 subsequent Supreme Court cases involving restrictions on access to abortion. Working hard out of my days for finer things in life. Happy life, then one peaceful night.
the boy who would hold me tight and leave me lonely with the colors from my womb. Sometimes he could not tell the difference between night and day. Intoxicated days had rearranged his way. Then my father, my own father, took a turn one day from my mother to the colors of my womb. Try to say when I might or when I may make the decisions that they set me up for anyway. Insult my mind, my rights, the issues of my womb.
That was Colors by Sweet Honey in the Rock. And now for Ani DiFranco with Lost Woman Song.
When I was 9 years old, I closed it when I was 18. I gave them every penny that I had saved, and they gave my blood and my urine a number. And now I'm sitting in this waiting room, playing with the toys. And I am here to exercise my freedom of choice. I passed their handheld signs, I went through their picket lines. They gathered when they saw me coming, they shouted when they saw me cross. I said, why don't you go home, just leave me alone. I'm just another woman lost. You are like fish in the water who don't know that they are wet. As far as I can tell, the world isn't perfect yet. His bored eyes were obscene, on his denim thighs a magazine. I wish he'd never come here with me. In fact, I wish he'd never come near me. I wish his shoulder wasn't touching mine. I am growing older, waiting in this line. But some of life's best lessons I learn at the worst times. And under the fierce fluorescent, she offered her hand for me to hold. She offered stability and calm, and I was crushing her palm through the pinch, pull, wincing. Oh, my smile unconvincing on that sterile battlefield that sees only casualties, never heroes. My heart hit absolute zero. And Lucille, your voice still sounds in me. Yeah, mine was a relatively easy tragedy. The profile of our country looks a little less hard-nosed, but you know that picket line persisted, and that clinic's since been closed. They keep pounding their fists on reality, hoping it will break. But you know, I don't think there's one of them that leads a life free of mistakes. but you can't make me sacrifice my freedom of choice. No, you can't make us sacrifice our freedom of choice.
That was Ani DeFranco with The Lost Woman Song. You're listening to Making Waves. Corporate media often looks at history, when it does at all, in a manner that makes it more palatable for the powerful. We heard from Reverend Hilson in our last hour about the way Martin Luther King's message has been de-radicalized so as not to offend those in power in white America. Now we hear an interview from Red Eye Radio, which takes on the way that Ariel Sharon's legacy is being sanitized in order to make him an acceptable hero.
Ariel Sharon hovers on the margin of life and death, but what is agreed is that his military political career is over. For the moment, the media are mythologizing the man. This frenzy has probably a short-lived shelf life. But while it lasts, it's all the more important to understand the real deeds and ambitions of Sharon. To help us in this task, we've contacted Ali Abu Nima in Chicago. Ali is one of the co-founders of and a regular contributor to Electronic Intifada. Electronic Intifada is the most thorough and reliable website in English on matters relating to Palestine and Israel. Good morning, Ali, and thank you for joining us again on Red Eye.
Good morning, Mordechai. It's a pleasure.
The current myth-making about Sharon reminds me of the whitewashing and saccharine tones that surrounded the death of Ronald Reagan. What do you make of this mythologizing?
It's extraordinary, the mythologizing of Sharon and the whitewashing of who he is and what he stood for and what he was doing up to the very last day of his consciousness, which is, you know, working backwards, ordering extrajudicial executions, the seizure of Palestinian land, really committing war crimes and serious violations of international law up until the day he was taken ill. But his career of murder and mayhem goes back half a century, and it's something that is well known by Palestinians, even if the rest of the world chooses to forget. And back to the 1950s, when he was in charge of the notorious Unit 101 and led attacks on Palestinian villages, and one that's particularly notorious was the attack on the village of Qibya in 1953, in which 69 Palestinian civilians, most of them women and children, were killed. And I just want to recall what the U.S. State Department said after the Qibya massacre. And it issued a statement expressing, quote, its deepest sympathy for the families of those who lost their lives. And it said that those responsible should be brought to account and that effective measures should be taken to prevent such incidents in the future. Unfortunately, instead of being brought to account, Sharon has enjoyed lifelong impunity for war crimes, not just in Qibya, but in the Gaza Strip in the early 1970s, then his invasion of Lebanon, which killed tens of thousands of Lebanese and Palestinian civilians, the massacres at the Sabra and Shatila refugee camps in Beirut, for which an Israeli commission found him personally responsible, and the word they used was personally responsible, up to the continued crimes that we see to this very day in the occupied territories.
These kind of history of crimes of war and crimes against humanity, as you say, dating from the incidents in Qibya and through Gaza and Lebanon and on to today, were well documented, and in fact they seem to have been well publicized even within the Jewish, Israeli, Hebrew language media. And he certainly got his name as the bulldozer because of those kind of aggressive and racist motivated tactics. So how is the trick being performed that this man, well known for all these atrocities in the past, is now, as George Bush labeled him, a man of peace?
Well, it's for a number of reasons. It is in large part due to the complicity of foreign governments that claim to uphold international law and claim to be interested in bringing to account the perpetrators of war crimes and crimes against humanity. Let's recall that some of the survivors of Ariel Sharon's war crimes have tried to pursue him in justice. And just a few years ago, in the courts of Belgium, victims of the Sabra-Nshatila massacres were successful in getting a case against him heard, which was really terrifying the Israeli authorities. But then under U.S. pressure, Belgium changed its law to prevent Belgium having jurisdiction over that. And we have seen countries like Canada, the United States, the United Kingdom, countries, again, that claim to be standing for the highest principles, colluding with Sharon, praising him. Jack Straw, the UK Foreign Secretary, delivered on the radio last week the most extraordinary paean to Ariel Sharon. You would have thought he was describing Mother Teresa. And part of this is because Sharon has pulled such an incredible bait and switch by convincing a lot of people that his so-called Gaza disengagement was part of a move towards peace rather than a part of a very aggressive effort by Israel to consolidate its territorial control over as much of Palestine as possible and to corral the Palestinians into what are effectively large concentration camps or open-air prisons, as Palestinians call them. And that while Sharon has been praised as a courageous leader for taking a few thousand settlers out of Gaza, the international community, and that includes, unfortunately, more and more the Canadian government, which used to be much more progressive on these issues, have turned a blind eye to the massive, massive ongoing expansion of settlements in the West Bank and the construction of the apartheid wall, which was ruled, of course, illegal by the International Court of Justice. So this impunity, this collusion with Israel, is really why Sharon is being mythologized in this way. We cannot simply lay the responsibility at the door of Israel. The responsibility has to go to all of those who, while pursuing Slobodan Milosevic, while pursuing other war criminals, accused war criminals from the Balkans, while praising the trial of Saddam Hussein, have simply allowed the blood of tens of thousands of Ariel Sharon's victims to simply flow into the ground with no accountability and total impunity.
Some commentators have situated Ariel Sharon in the tradition of Israel's first prime minister, another man whose policies are much mythologized, David Ben-Gurion of the Labour Party, rather than seeing him as essentially a inheritor of the Likud Party tradition, which he was part of in recent years. What do you think of that connection between the agenda of Ben-Gurion and Ariel Sharon?
Well, they're similar in the sense that both were always committed to maximum territorial expansion of Israel. Sharon, up until his last conscious moment, Israel announced massive expansion of the settlements since the so-called Gaza disengagement, which Sharon fully approved and spearheaded. And their effort was always to control the maximum amount of land with the minimum number of Palestinians. And that has been the consistent stream through Israeli Zionist policy from the very beginning, and it hasn't changed. There are a lot of people who want to believe, who are prepared to turn a blind eye to all of this because they're looking for hope, and so they want to believe that the Gaza disengagement was the beginning of the end of this conflict rather than simply the beginning of a much more bitter and intractable phase. And all of the mythologizing of Sharon to try to make us believe that, you know, he was a great man like Yitzhak Rabin before him, that these were peacemakers, none of this is going to make any difference. Sharon's policies were not the policies of one man. They were the policies of the Israeli establishment, and they will continue no matter who replaces him, and they will continue until the world decides to confront Israeli aggression, to hold Israel accountable, to force Israel to comply with so many Security Council resolutions that lie a gathering dust on the shelf. There will be no peace unless injustice is confronted. There are a lot of people out there, Mordechai, a lot of well-meaning people who think you can get peace just by sitting around a table and singing songs and playing the guitar. It doesn't work that way. There has to be confrontation of the injustice. And when there is confrontation, people get uncomfortable, people get upset, but unfortunately we're not going to get to peace unless this apartheid system is taken on, fought, and defeated so that all Israelis and Palestinians can finally live in peace and security.
You refer to the international community. I want to go back, accepting that point as being very vital, to the Jewish-Israeli political culture, because what seems to be undoubtedly true is that Ariel Sharon is ending his military and political career at the height of his popularity. And what does that tell us about the prospects for a authentic and viable peace movement in Jewish-Israeli society?
Well, I think that there are a lot of people in Israeli society and among North American supporters of Israel who believe that Israel can have its cake and eat it, that Israel can have international legitimacy, that it can be a Jewish state, that it can be a democracy, without really recognizing the equality and the fullness of the rights of Palestinians. So you have a lot of opinion polls that say that 60, 70, 80% of American Jews and the Israelis support the Gaza disengagement, that they support a Palestinian state, that they see this as necessary for Israel's long-term future. But when you get down to the detail and ask how many are willing to support a total withdrawal from the settlements, a fair compromise over Jerusalem, the numbers collapse. So they want to have their cake and eat it, and I think it's because they've been misled by Israeli leaders for decades into believing we can build settlements and talk peace at the same time. It doesn't work that way. Throughout the years of the peace process, the Oslo process, Israel talked about peace while continuing to commit aggression, to confiscate land, to build settlements. During the years of the peace process, so-called, over 1 million Palestinian olive trees were uprooted by Israeli settlers and soldiers. More than 4,000 homes were demolished during the years of the so-called peace process. More than 100,000 people were made homeless, and hundreds of square kilometers of Palestinian land were confiscated for the exclusive use of Jews. Israelis and American Jews have to decide whether they want peace or settlements and conquest. And so far, unfortunately, the most influential parts of those communities haven't yet made up their mind about that. They don't stand up and say clearly, we condemn what Israel is doing. And now I'm talking about, of course, the leading pro-Israel organization. There are very courageous voices from within Israel and from within the North American Jewish community who have been very, very critical and, I think, essential voices. But we need to hold the mainstream pro-Israel groups accountable, that they cannot keep supporting war crimes, violations of international law, and at the same time saying they want peace. It doesn't work that way.
Thank you very much, Ali, for that clarity. We appreciate your time.
It's my pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I've been speaking with Ali Abu-Nima. He's the co-founder of and writer for Electronic Intifada. And check out their website. You can find it at electronicintifada.net.
This is Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice. We now bring you Between the Lines, independent radio out of Bridgeport, Connecticut.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Dr. James Jennings, president of Conscience International, who examines the escalating confrontation between Washington, its European allies, and Iran over that nation's nuclear ambitions. Kim Gandy, president of the National Organization for Women, who assesses the recently concluded Senate confirmation hearings and her group's strong opposition to Supreme Court nominee Samuel Alito. And Glenn Sugamelli, an attorney with the group Earth Justice, who discusses why environmental activists also oppose Judge Alito's confirmation to the Supreme Court. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The London-based Guardian newspaper reports Sudan has become a new way station for advanced technology to make nuclear weapons. A classified intelligence report claims Sudan set up front companies and used third countries to import machine tools and high-tech processing equipment, far too advanced for the nation to use. Much of the equipment is now missing. Pakistani nuclear scientist A.Q. Khan, who ran a black market for nuclear weapons technology, visited Sudan at least once before he was arrested. Khan remains under house arrest in Pakistan. He helped supply high-tech equipment to Libya, Iran, and North Korea to build centrifuges to enrich uranium. Intelligence sources cited by The Guardian say the Khan black market network and a separate Iranian nuclear network are implicated in the missing equipment. European intelligence points to a state-owned firm in Khartoum, which has offices in Tehran, Moscow, Istanbul, and Beijing, as being at the center of the nuclear technology enterprise. 3 years after President George Bush promised zero tolerance for human trafficking among U.S. contractors overseas, the Pentagon has failed to approve a policy to ban prostitution or forced labor. According to the Chicago Tribune, a proposal to ban trafficking among contractors was debated last summer, but ran into stiff opposition from major defense contractors like Halliburton. Another big contractor, DynCorp, had its workers implicated in buying women and girls as sex slaves in Bosnia in the late 1990s. Advocates against human trafficking called the Pentagon plan ineffective. They are demanding mandatory referrals to prosecutors. This would prevent contractors from sending implicated employees back to the U.S. before a full-scale investigation could begin. In late December, a bill renewing the congressional ban on human trafficking easily passed in the House, but only after a provision creating a trafficking watchdog in the Pentagon was cut out of the bill at the request of pro-contractor lawmakers. In the first 2 weeks of the Medicare drug program, a dozen states declared health emergencies to deal with computer problems, jammed phone lines, and thousands of elderly and disabled patients being denied medicines. According to the Washington Post, 6.4 million low-income senior citizens who received free drugs until January 1st found themselves in a maze of large insurance deductibles, copayments, and denials of coverage. A dozen states have committed to pay for these drugs. As Gene Feinberg of the National Senior Citizens Law Center explained, all this is doing is harming people who had coverage, America's most vulnerable citizens. The 6.4 million low-income seniors previously got medication through state Medicaid plans that were converted to the new Medicaid drug benefit program. California is expected to spend $70 million to provide 2 weeks of prescriptions to low-income seniors and expects the federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid to reimburse them. Initially, the Bush administration said it could not afford to pay back the states. Maine was the first state to declare an emergency, as dialysis patients were denied medications under Medicare, and some seniors received a letter saying the deductibles would be taken out of their Social Security checks. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Ruben Abreu.
In an escalating war of words, the U.S., joined by Britain, France, and Germany, are pressuring Iran to reverse its resumption of nuclear research. After restarting work on converting uranium at its Isfahan nuclear facility in August, the Iranian government broke the seals on several facilities engaged in uranium enrichment in early January. This move, which violated a voluntary agreement between Tehran, Paris, London, and Berlin, prompted a demand from the Europeans to refer the matter to the International Atomic Energy Agency and ultimately to the UN Security Council. While Washington and its European allies have called for the Security Council to impose sanctions on Iran if it refuses to freeze its nuclear activities, Russia and China, both with veto power on the Council, have taken a more cautious approach. Iran maintains that it seeks only to build nuclear power plants to produce energy and does not seek atomic weaponry. With negotiations making little progress, Bush administration officials and their Israeli counterparts have left open the option of a military solution, interpreted by many as meaning airstrikes targeting Iran's nuclear research facilities. Dr. James Jennings, president of Conscience International, led a delegation of U.S. professors to Tehran in September for dialogue on the growing confrontation between the two nations. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Dr. Jennings about the current conflict between Iran and the West and the options available to avoid a military confrontation.
When the Iranians broke those seals, they set in motion what I think is probably an inevitable march towards some kind of conflict coming up, and the UN will be complicit in that. President Bush just stated that the UN Security Council is a part of a diplomatic solution. But it seems that we're going through the same drill that we went through leading up to the Iraq War, and that certainly did not end in a diplomatic solution, even though they got a certain kind of resolution from the UN, that the military force was the implied threat hanging over all of this. And I frankly expect it to develop into that unless a change in course is evident.
Dr. Jennings, what's your view, having recently visited Iran, what's your view of why the Iranians are pursuing the nuclear energy program that they maintain is strictly for civilian use, while the Bush administration, of course, accuses Iran of ultimately trying to build an atomic weapon?
The question here is what is the intention of the Iranians? And it reminds me a little bit of the cause we went to war in Iraq ultimately came down to what's in the mind of Saddam Hussein. And I thought that was a pretty poor way to decide questions of national policy, because you don't really know what's in the mind of another person. But let's say, for the purpose of argument, that Iran does intend to have nuclear weapons. John McLaughlin, former deputy director of CIA, said on CNN that Iran is some years away from having a nuclear weapon. And the same was true with Iraq, but we went to war anyway. I think that one has to be very careful about going to war on the basis of what may be in the minds of somebody else. At the same time, the Iranians have insisted that they are only interested in nuclear energy and not nuclear weapons, but they are serious about having nuclear energy. And of course, their neighbors, India and Pakistan, have the nuclear weapons already, and they feel, with Israel having so many nuclear weapons that have never been inspected by IAEA, that they have a right to have these weapons. And I firmly support the IAEA and the international community monitoring this so that weapons are not proliferated.
Short of military action, the U.S. and its allies are threatening economic sanctions against Iran, and in turn, they are threatening to cut off oil supplies, which would greatly increase the price of oil worldwide and with some fairly serious economic consequences. Do you see that as something that will play out, given that economic sanctions short of military attack is really the only tool the U.S. and its European allies have?
Well, Iran is in a different geostrategic position than Iraq and cannot be blackmailed or brought to its knees in the way that Iraq was under the sanctions. Iran cannot be closed off in the borders like that. So they're going to go ahead and trade with whoever they want to, no matter what sanctions are there. I still don't think the sanctions are a good idea, and they will create a backlash, which will drive up the price of oil. But if you think about it, it was the neoconservative ideology that led us into the mess in Iraq. So the question is how committed President Bush is to a neoconservative dogma. They have a dogma of full-spectrum dominance, military control of the world. And my guess is that he and the other leading hawks like Cheney and Rumsfeld are not ready to give up their attempt to reorganize the Middle East militarily into a colony of the American empire. So we're hearing the same insistent drumbeat from them that led the U.S. into the quagmire in Iraq. They're saying Iran has a madman at the helm. Iran is a threat to the entire world. Iran will soon have nuclear weapons. Iran intends to attack its neighbors. The West cannot allow an Islamic bomb to be developed. The U.N. Security Council must act. Sanctions must be imposed. And I should say that I have no great love for the present regime in Iran. We met with President Khatami, and now we have the new president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, who seems to be going back to the old-time religion of Ayatollah Khomeini and saying the kinds of things he has said about Israel, which was the straight doctrine that Khomeini taught anyway, and most people in Iran know that. So it resonates differently in Iran than it does in the West, which is, it sounds very scary.
What could the U.S. And the European allies, France, Germany, and Britain, what could all these countries do to move negotiations forward and avoid what many, including you, are thinking is the inevitable use of military force here?
Well, I think that a massive effort to understand and interact with the Iranian leadership would be the first thing. And if it doesn't work, then, of course, you always have other options down the line. But you can engage these people. Most Middle Eastern leaders are shrewd if they're not very sophisticated. And, you know, they might, in fact, be human, and they might be human beings susceptible to pressure or to inducement, just as normal politicians would be, instead of being monsters or demons. Once the people are demonized, and of course the Iranians demonized the West and have for a long time, but both sides need to cool down the rhetoric and engage in rational dialogue. That could avoid a crisis. I'm quite sure of that, but I don't think either side will probably take that option. I guess I could quote John McCain here and say that I disagree with him. He says only one thing is worse than a war with Iran, and that is Iran with a nuclear bomb. Well, I would say there's only one thing worse than the president and the neoconservatives leading us into an illegal and unjustified war with Iraq, and that is to have a similar war hyped up on insufficient evidence with Iran. And that's coming unless people make their voices heard about this issue.
That was Dr. James Jennings, president of Conscience International. Contact the group at area code 678-513-7565 or visit their website at www.conscienceinternational.org. The U.S. Senate hearings on President Bush's Supreme Court nominee, Samuel Alito, ended on January 13th, with many opponents disturbed by his judicial philosophy and critical of the judge's unwillingness to answer many questions. The 4 days of hearings focused on Judge Alito's opinion on several key issues, including the Supreme Court landmark Roe v. Wade decision legalizing abortion, civil rights, and the limits of presidential power. Other questions revolved around Judge Alito's membership in Concerned Alumni of Princeton, an avowedly racist and sexist group, and court cases he helped decide involving companies in which he has investments. With the Republican Party firmly in control of the Senate and Pennsylvania Pro-Choice Judiciary Committee Chair Arlen Specter announcing his support for Alito, the conventional wisdom is that President Bush's nominee will be easily confirmed. Even opponents of Judge Alito, like Senator Dianne Feinstein of California, said that while she will vote against the nominee, she would not participate in a filibuster to block his confirmation. However, a coalition of progressive groups around the nation are not buying the conventional wisdom and have launched a campaign to convince enough Democrats and moderate Republicans to stop Mr. Alito from replacing retiring Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with Kim Gandy, president of the National Organization for Women, who assesses the Senate confirmation hearings and explains why her group is strongly opposing the nomination of Samuel Alito.
I was in awe, I have to say, as a lawyer, of his ability to give so many responses without giving any real answers. It was masterful, is all I could say. I mean, if I hadn't really known the issues that were being asked about, if I hadn't myself read the cases, read the opinions he wrote that he was being asked about, it would have sounded like he had answered the questions. And so there was a lot of frustration on my part. I told a reporter a few days ago that I just sat there wishing that there was someone there to whom I could say, Your Honor, will you please instruct the witness to answer the question? Because he just didn't respond. And I think that the particularly the Democratic questioners were extremely frustrated that they couldn't get him to answer even questions that John Roberts had answered. For instance, John Roberts was willing to say that it was, in his own hearing, that it was unconstitutional, that it was a violation of an individual's constitutional rights to execute that person if they were, in fact, innocent of a crime. A scenario was set up where it has been, a person's been convicted, but it has now been conclusively determined that the person was not guilty, but they're on death row. Do they have a constitutional right not to be executed if it has been determined conclusively that that person is innocent? Now Chief Justice Roberts was willing to say, well, yes, if it's been determined they're innocent, you can't execute them. Judge Alito would not answer the question. He went all around it. He went up and down every direction. He would not say it. And I think you have to conclude that his answer is no.
Kim Gandy, what are your biggest concerns about Alito and his possible accession to the Supreme Court?
Well, from the point of view of women's rights, and which is the area that I work in every day, we're very concerned about reproductive rights, not just Roe v. Wade, not just abortion, but birth control as well. He's made statements in writing that many forms of birth control are what he calls abortifacients. That commonly is thought to mean the IUD, the birth control pill, and the morning after pill. And what that means is that by his reckoning, at least, if abortion rights are gone, then that also means that what we commonly think of as birth control would also be gone, because he considers those things to be abortifacients and not birth control, leaving us with the rhythm method and condoms, which is not very effective. And I think people dismiss that idea, but, you know, you should read what this guy's written. Just because he looks very much like the guy next door and acts like the guy next door, he has some pretty far out thoughts about these things. I just read that in the last three terms of the court, there were 54 decisions that were 5-4, which, considering that they only hear about 100 cases a year, 54 5-4 decisions is really, really extraordinary. And guess who was the deciding vote, the one who decided whether it went 5 or whether it went 4? In every case, 39 of the 54 cases, Sandra Day O'Connor decided which way it went. So that's the seat that we're talking about putting this man into. He would literally, for the cases that aren't clear, for the cases that the court is split on, he would then become the deciding vote in 39 out of 54. That's over two-thirds.
Kim Gandy, what do you make of the Democrats being lukewarm about a filibuster or other extreme measures to oppose Samuel Alito nomination to the Supreme Court? And what is your campaign? What are you doing? What is Now and a coalition of groups doing to stir up the public and to pressure politicians in Washington to oppose this nomination?
Well, there's no question that the Republicans have made threat after threat that if the Democrats use their right to filibuster, that the Republicans will take it away from them forever. But as far as I'm concerned, if you're not going to use it now, when are you going to use it? When could it be more important than our civil rights and civil liberties on the line with a person like this on the Supreme Court, who seems to have no qualms about following his ideology wherever it leads and seeing no barriers, particularly to presidential and executive power? We've had people come in from over the last 2 weeks from 35 different states to lobby their senators, to deliver letters and petitions from back home, to walk the halls of Congress and to get on the telephones and call people back home and ask them to make calls as well. And now we're changing the message to say, if you vote no on Alito, it doesn't count unless you filibuster. A no vote without a filibuster is a yes vote.
That was Kim Gandy, president of the National Organization for Women. Contact Now by calling area code 202-628-8669. Or visit their website at www.now.org. As the Senate Judiciary Committee hearings on the confirmation of Judge Samuel Alito to the Supreme Court concluded, most of the reporting focused on Alito's views about abortion and presidential power. But environmental groups are also troubled by some of Judge Alito's rulings on environmental protection during his 15-year judicial career. Four of the nation's major leading environmental organizations were so alarmed that for the first time in 20 years, they publicly opposed a Supreme Court nominee. Activists say that Alito's views indicate that he would, under the Commerce Clause, support challenges to environmental regulations by polluters and developers. Among the laws they fear Alito would help overturn or weaken include the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, the Endangered Species Act, and the Safe Drinking Water Act. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Glenn Sugamelli, senior legislative counsel with Earth Justice, a law firm that defends the interests of individuals and environmental groups in court against violations of the nation's environmental laws. He discusses why environmental activists oppose Judge Alito's confirmation and what they are doing about it.
The reason why Earth Justice has joined with other national environmental groups to oppose a Supreme Court nominee for the first time since Robert Bork in 1987. There have been eight nominees since Bork until now. None have been opposed by environmental groups. Now we join with Sierra Club, Clean Water Action, Friends of the Earth, and other groups to oppose this nomination because Judge Alito has a record that threatens the very existence of federal environmental laws and the ability to enforce those. For example, there's a case called Magnesium Electron from New Jersey, where there had been a citizens group that had filed a lawsuit and proved that a polluter had violated the Clean Water Act 150 times. They also proved, as Judge Alito testified, that they used the water downstream from the pollution in order to fish, to drink the water, to walk along the water, to enjoy it, and they were no longer doing that because they were concerned from the toxic pollution upstream. And yet, in light of all that, he still threw them out of court and basically said, in order to get into court to even hear your case, even after the case had, there had already been $1 million fine imposed, and even though it was very clear and unchallenged that the law had been violated 150 times, he still said that these people who use the water directly downstream from the pollution had to prove essentially that that pollution was resulting in the water they were using being toxic. It wasn't enough to just show the law was violated. It wasn't enough to show that the people were hurt. They had to show essentially that the particular pollution resulted in specific harm to the overall river. Well, that's not the way the law works. And the Supreme Court, two or three years later, recognized that. A case called Laidlaw, 7-2, the Supreme Court essentially reversed and rejected the reasoning that Judge Alito used and recognized that Congress had given people the right to enforce the Clean Water Act in order to ensure that the waters are protected when the administration fails to enforce it. He also has another case under the Safe Drinking Water Act. And in that case, he overturned an emergency action by EPA to protect the safe drinking water of Lansing, Michigan from toxic pollution by W.R. Grace, a big company. Again, there was a multi-million-dollar fine, and he voted to throw it out over a judge who was saying, this is not right. We're supposed to uphold emergency EPA actions to protect the public health, except in the most extreme cases. And he was asked about that by Senator Feinstein. He was asked about his decision on restricting people's ability to go to court to enforce environmental laws by Senator Feinstein and Senator Leahy. There were a lot of questions at the hearing that showed that the environment really was a major issue in the minds of a number of the key senators. And we were pleased by that. And unfortunately, Judge Alito did not respond very well. He did not really admit that he would reconsider the results of those opinions. He didn't even admit that the Supreme Court had essentially reversed his opinion, which had denied people the right to go to court to enforce the Clean Water Act.
Most of the coverage of the hearings seems to have focused on Judge Alito's views regarding Roe v. Wade and also on presidential power. Environmental issues haven't seemed to play as much of a role.
There actually was a lot of discussion at the hearings and a lot of questions at the hearings about environmental issues specifically, and particularly about Supreme Court decisions that have cut back on Congress's authority under the Constitution to pass laws that affect interstate commerce. And that is a very big deal because that is the constitutional provision that is the basis for most federal environmental laws. It's also the basis for civil rights laws and labor laws and consumer laws. He really seems to have pretty entrenched views that are very threatening to Congress's authority to pass laws that affect interstate commerce, which includes the Clean Water Act, the Endangered Species Act, the Safe Drinking Water Act.
I'm curious about what kind of record Justice O'Connor has had on environmental cases.
Justice O'Connor has often been a swing vote on the environment, as she has in so many other issues. What Justice O'Connor tends to do in her opinions is to write pretty narrowly and carefully and cautiously, not to have a very draconian, like severe, unintended consequences. And that has been important. Even when she's voted against the environment, it's tended to be in a limited, careful fashion. And in other cases, she's been very much of the swing vote or dissenting vote, arguing to protect the environment. We're doing everything we can to make sure that the Senate is not a rubber stamp and that they do the right thing, because this is a lifetime nomination to replace the swing justice, Sandra Day O'Connor, on the court. And the fate of federal environmental and public health safeguards for decades to come really could very well depend upon the results of this nomination.
That was Glenn Sugimelli, Senior Legislative Counsel with Earth Justice. Contact the group by calling area code 202-667-4500 or visit their website at www.earthjustice.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Ruben Abreu, Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Vanzari.
Thanks for listening to Making Waves, Independent Voices for Peace and Justice. The Making Waves crew is Amy Antonucci, Steve Diamond, Tom Jackson, Stanley Longstaff, Joanne Paradise, and Damon Thomas. We welcome your participation, too. Our theme music is by New Hampshire women's drum group Tabalat, and our mid-show music is Evening Stars by Alice Gomez. Please email nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com to get involved. You can live stream our show on Saturdays from 2 to 4 if you're not in range of the station by going to www.wirenh.com. Tune in next Saturday from 2 to 4 for our next Making Waves program. We leave you with this quote by Martin Luther King Jr. A nation that continues, year after year, to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death.